Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to this fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, downloaded via the internet from San Francisco. This program is supported by great listeners, and we name names: Mark Dennis, Don Cisney, Stuart Smith, and a new subscriber, a voluntary subscriber who works in the media in San Francisco, who said, "No last name, please." So for us, he's Joe Doe. And thank you, Joe. If you're able and you'd like to help, go to my website, peterbcollins.com. On the homepage, on the right-hand side, are the links for your voluntary subscriptions, starting at $5 a month. In the second portion of this podcast, we're going to talk to Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear about the amazing revelations about how Japanese authorities lied to us about the status of the Fukushima reactors after the tsunami and earthquake. Germany's decision to shut down virtually all of its nuclear power plants. We'll talk about that and much more. But first, we're going to talk about a late, great investigative journalist, Gary Webb, who took his own life on December 10th of 2004 at the age of 49. And in his career, he broke a lot of important stories, and he was essentially broken by the work that he did. We're going to talk about that with two contributors to a new book that is a collection of reportage from Gary Webb. It's called The Killing Game, and it's out in softcover from Seven Stories Press. And it includes some of the articles that Gary wrote over the years. And the two people joining me to talk about Gary Webb's work are Jeffrey Klein, an investigative journalist who co-founded Mother Jones, where he directed exposés of Newt Gingrich, Big Tobacco, and the introduction of offensive weapons into space. He also co-produced for the PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer a series on China's economy that won a Gerald Loeb Award. He taught journalism at Stanford, San Francisco State, and the University of California, Berkeley, and spent 10 years at the Mercury News, one of the papers where Gary Webb worked. Jeffrey Klein, welcome to our program.
Glad to be on the air.
Nice to talk with you. And returning is Robert Perry, the longtime investigative journalist based in Washington who worked for AP and Frontline and did a lot of important reporting on the Iran-Contra affair, which figures into some of the reporting that Gary Webb did. And Robert Perry now writes for the nonprofit journalism site that he manages, consortiumnews.com. Bob, welcome back.
Thanks, Peter.
And Jeffrey, let me start with you, and let's first profile Gary Webb, because there are many people who may have heard his name but really don't know that much about him. Give us a quick thumbnail of Gary and your impression of the work that he did.
Well, at the Mercury, where Gary came after having been at the Kentucky Post and the Cleveland Plain Dealer, he was the real thing. He was a complete star. He was a hard-ass investigative reporter. He didn't suffer a fool slightly, and he liked going after big stories. I would say he fits with my definition of what the great investigative journalists do, is he tried to tell readers something that people in authority did not want them to know. And he did that repeatedly. He did that with boards of medical quality assurance that were trying to hide bad doctors. He did it with trying to hide mob ties to coal mines. He did many, many stories. And by the time he came to the Mercury, where I edited the Sunday magazine, he was in great demand by the editors to do work for them because he'd never been proved wrong. He was an impeccable investigative reporter.
And let me just add, from my own perspective, Jeffrey, that this was during a period when the San Jose Mercury News really was the best newspaper in the San Francisco Bay Area. And the resources that Knight Ridder put into the paper were largely drawn from Silicon Valley and the highly profitable classified ads that were still in print at that point. They've all moved online now, and that's been a loss of revenue to newspapers that have helped fuel the decline in the size of newsrooms and the resources available for investigative reporting. So,
yeah, it's a dark irony that the Mercury was able to hire the most ambitious reporters in the country because Craig of Craigslist had not put a dagger through the heart of newspapers yet.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
All the jobs for Intel, whatever, that had to be advertised in Silicon Valley, and all the homes of people coming in and out had to go through our classified sections, and we were minting money, and therefore we were able to hire the most ambitious people in the country. To give a parallel example, I hired Susan Faludi on my magazine staff before she went on to her illustrious career.
Well, and I'll just mention that recruiting advertising in the Mercury was also a source of income for a guy like me, because in the 80s, I made good money producing radio and TV commercials for Intel and Four Phase and Motorola and the other Valley companies that were recruiting, because there were so many classified ads in the Mercury News. In order to get people to notice them, we spent extra money on radio and TV commercials to say, look for our ad in the Mercury News.
And this will come back into our conversation because, as Bob's going to, I'm sure, point out, the reason that Gary was finally done in was the Mercury had enough money and had enough tech skill to put up really the first internet story. And it was the presence of Gary's story on the internet which eventually led to his suicide in a circuitous way.
And Jeffrey, just one more item from you before I turn to Bob Perry, and that is that given the profitability of the Mercury and the level of journalism that was practiced there, you really were going into serious competition with the big nationally known daily metropolitan papers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the L.A. Times here on the West Coast. And this also will play into some of the rivalries and the way that the East Coast media dismissed the critical reporting of Gary Webb.
Yes, with the caveat that I would say the editors at the Mercury and the top management, although they were making as high a salaries as anyone in the industry, they essentially wanted the acceptance of the Post, the Times, and the LA Times, who controlled the prize committees. So basically, the Mercury News wanted it both ways. It wanted to play with the big boys, but it also wanted the approval of the big boys. And ultimately, it went on the side of their approval and put a knife in the back of its own reporter.
Now, Bob Perry, as I mentioned, you broke a lot of important stories related to the Iran-Contra affair during the 1980s, and that really created the mountain of information that Gary dug into, and his controversial series of stories about the use of aircraft that were being used to ferry weapons to the Contras in Central America. The same planes were being used to bring cocaine back to the United States. And Webb also reported that the development of crack was something that occurred at this same time. And the inference was that the CIA, because it was running these weapons flights to Central America, and that they had to know what was coming back on those flights, and therefore that they bore some of the responsibility for the cocaine and crack epidemic that spiraled in the 1980s.
Right. Basically, the situation was that the Reagan administration was determined to support the Nicaraguan Contra rebels who were fighting a leftist government back in the 1980s, And when the Congress tried to curtail and then cut off aid to the Contras, the Reagan administration went to the mat to try to ensure the Contras had sufficient support, and that included essentially turning a blind eye to many of the criminal and violent activities of the Contras, not just their involvement in the drug trade, but also their involvement in human rights violations, and partly because the votes on Contra aid in the U.S. Congress were so close and so frequent, the Reagan administration was particularly sensitive to any negative publicity that would be written about the Contras. So, strangely, in the case of the Afghan rebels who were also involved in the drug trade, the heroin trade, since that was fairly widely accepted in Congress, there were no close votes on aid to the Afghan rebels, there was actually more honest reporting in places like the New York Times about the problem of the Afghan rebels being involved in heroin trafficking. But when it came to the Contras, the Reagan administration fought tooth and nail against any negative publicity because it felt it had to, because the next vote was just around the corner always, and the votes were always very close. So there was this determination to shut down any critical journalism about the Contras, and so in 1985, when my colleague Brian Barger and I at AP wrote the first story about the Contras getting involved in the drug trade as a way to support themselves, that story came under fairly severe attack too, and basically the New York Times, the Washington Post, did not want to really challenge the Reagan administration on this, and the view that the Contras were involved in the drug trade became very controversial. And even though the evidence kept building up, there was always this pushback, this extraordinary pushback in Washington by the Reagan people, and essentially picked up by much of the establishment press that was very scared about challenging the Reagan administration on this. So by the time you get through the 80s, even though the evidence has kept accumulating about the Contras being involved in the drug trade and the Reagan administration and the CIA protecting that, or at least turning a blind eye to it, there was kind of a conventional wisdom that, oh, that must be a conspiracy theory. It didn't matter how much evidence there was. And so the story kind of dies. It peters out, even though sometimes even the federal government would bring this evidence forward. For instance, when Manuel Noriega was detained in Panama, and when he was put on trial, the federal prosecutors used some of the same witnesses to say that the Contras were involved in the drug trade and that Noriega was helping them. So even when that kind of evidence was brought forward, there was this strange division, because Washington had grown very offended and annoyed by this scandal, and many of the major papers picked up on that. So there was this hostility. It was more than just a kind of a desire not to have it come up. It was an annoyance and anger when this issue did come up, in part because the New York Times and the Washington Post had sort of landed on the side of defending the Contras and attacking these stories and ridiculing people like Senator John Kerry when he investigated this for the Senate. So that was kind of the climate when Gary Webb shows up in the mid-1990s wanting to revive this story based on new evidence that he had about some of the consequences in Los Angeles and around the country from this cocaine that the Contras were helping to bring in. He was going up against a very stiff headwind.
And Jeffrey Klein, what was the atmosphere in the newsroom at the Mercury at the time Gary Webb was working on this, what became a three-part series? And I want to underscore that this wasn't published until 1996, and the events that he wrote about were 10 to 15 years in the past. And why was it so explosive, so radioactive at the time it was published?
Well, first of all, I had gone by then. I knew Gary when he first came to the paper, but I had gone back to be the editor of Mother Jones. I had a little contact with him, but I had a lot of contact with my friends there, and I knew all the personnel and the top editors. So at a second-hand remove, I can tell you the atmosphere was still a great drive to produce prize-winning stories. So, to some extent, they were cliched. You'd have these massive three- or four-part series that were essentially, they might have just sent them into the Pulitzer Committee because that's what they were going for.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no problem with Gary's story initially. And then, as I mentioned, it went out on the Mercury was quite advanced in its Mercury Center. They did a great job of putting it out there and showing people around the country what were Gary's sources. And it got picked up in particular by Black Radio in Los Angeles and elsewhere. So the CIA had done a very smart thing initially, which was to ignore it, just to pretend that the stories didn't have existed. And had the Internet not been around, even in its infancy, they would have been successful. But now they had particularly congresspeople from the Black Caucus calling for investigations, and so they had to fight back. And they fought back in an extremely sophisticated fashion, which, as Bob has anticipated, they set the top star national security reporters against the Mercury News. And then the Mercury News began a series of backtrackings because they didn't want to be, couldn't stand the persistent attack by the three leading papers. Initially, they said it was a fine story. They didn't have any problem with it whatsoever. It was in the glare and the intense pressure from the top media that caused the Mercury to pull back from the story. And then there's a second part, which is once they pulled back, they wanted Gary to pull back. And Gary was of a nature that I admire, which he said, why should I pull back when everything I wrote was true? And because he wouldn't do that, in other words, he was not a good soldier as far as the newsroom was concerned, they exiled him. They exiled him to a very distant bureau, and they essentially sent him out to Siberia with the hope that he would disappear.
Yeah. And it's important to note that virtually all of the allegations that he made in his series have been validated, and he has been vindicated. That didn't repair his career and didn't really occur in time for him to recognize that before he took his life.
Well, that's not entirely accurate, Peter.
Great. Straighten me out. Go ahead.
Well, perhaps the most important thing that Gary Webb did that, frankly, Barger and I had failed to do was to generate the kind of pressure for a serious investigation. You know, our initial reporting had spurred John Kerry to do some pretty good work in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But we that itself got sidetracked under a lot of pressure. But what Webb did in 96 was to, and with the help of the Congressional Black Caucus, was to force the CIA to finally take a pretty serious look at this. They happened to have a quality inspector general, Frederick Hitz, who took his assignment quite seriously and went ahead and really investigated this. And what Hitz reports in two volumes, that came out in 1998, a couple years after Webb's story, and Webb is already at this point, he's already been forced out of the Mercury News in disgrace and so forth. But what Hitz discovered was that the Contra cocaine problem was actually much worse than any of us had anticipated or understood. That the Contras, really from their beginnings in 1980, when they were first taking shape after the Sandinista Revolution in 1979, that the Contras had become involved with drug traffickers, and that somewhat it tied to the fact that the Argentines were helping them out initially, and the Argentines had been working in Bolivia and elsewhere with their sort of international anti-communist crusade. And then the Contras, over the next decade, repeatedly, and this was like dozens and dozens of units and individuals, including top-ranking Contras, were implicated in the cocaine trafficking going through Central America and up into the United States. So that material actually was available by 1998 and was released publicly. This is where the big three newspapers, I think, were even more cynical in how they approached this. They had initially, back in 96, after Webb was getting a lot of attention, they attacked him and the story. They kind of were all over the place as to whether the Contras really were doing drug trafficking. They kind of acknowledged that there was some of that going on, but sort of played it down. But then when the Hitz reports came out in 98, the New York Times finally put on the front page a story saying, well, you know, there really was more here than we had thought. They said that 50 some Contra units and individuals had been implicated in the drug trade, that the CIA had known about it in real time, that the agency officials had chosen to ignore it and even to cover it up because they didn't want this negative information to impact on what they saw was their bigger concern, which was getting rid of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. So all this was out there. The New York Times, though, included that in sort of a grudging way. They had half the story attacking Gary Webb. They continued that approach. But they did include this. Now, this is so then the report comes out publicly, so it's available. The L.A. Times, which had gone in very hard attacking Webb and attacking the whole series, refuses to publish anything about the CIA's admission. The Washington Post, about a month after the report comes out, does a very superficial story, which just sort of glosses over what the report actually contains. This is when I was at ConsortiumNews.com. I was like going through all the stuff, and because I knew all of the background anyway, was pulling the stuff together and presenting it. But we weren't getting much attention, frankly. So the big newspapers essentially knew what Webb had written was substantially correct, because you could always quibble with some details of it, but that he was really onto something very important. But they chose to continue to dump on him or ignore the information rather than admit they had been wrong. They did not want to admit that they had screwed this up. And they'd screwed it up not just in 96 when they attacked Webb. They'd been screwing it up since the mid-1980s. And this goes to the point, I guess, of the book by Mark Hertzgaard, the book about how the press reacted, sort of related to the Reagan administration, and the name of the book was On Bended Knee. And that was really what had happened to the National Press Corps. It had gone on bended knee. And so what we saw here was not that Gary didn't know that he was vindicated. It was that really no one else knew that he was vindicated, because the big papers had chosen to simply stick with their position that they weren't going to admit this. It didn't matter what the CIA admitted, even. The New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times were essentially going to continue to poo-poo this story. So Webb did know that he was vindicated. The problem was that he remained a pariah in his own profession.
Well, thanks for straightening me out. And Jeffrey, go ahead and add to that.
That's the key, is what Bob said. And it makes it a much sadder and more instructive story, is he'd gotten it right. If anything, he had underestimated the seriousness of it. It had been corrected in various places that any reporter or any management at a top paper could see. But he remained, as Bob said, a pariah, and that social shunning, besides whatever material circumstances were hurting him in his own life and the psychic injuries he suffered as a result of this, were enough for him to want to take his own life. He knew he had gotten something right, and yet being cast out for a profession that he had performed at the highest level, it was the break. He could not put together his own idealism with what actually occurred to him in his own profession. Somewhere in that nexus was an unbearable emotional burden. And I think this is a story that repeats frequently in the United States journalism, and I would say admiring Mark Hertzgaard and on bended knee, I would say the press is on a complete bended knee to a less ostensibly despicable character in Obama. So there are lines that you don't cross as a reporter, and if you do, you do so at the risk of your own emotional life.
And there's almost something worse than getting a story wrong and having to face up to that. That's not obviously something any reporter wants to do. But when you've gotten the story right, and you're in, and basically your entire community, your colleagues, believe you got it wrong for whatever their reason, and treat you that way, it's almost worse. Because you really, you can't apologize for it. You can't say, gee, I made a mistake, and, you know, give me a break. You're stuck. You have to sort of stand with your story, even if all the smart guys around you and smart gals around you are laughing and mocking you and saying, ha-ha, you got it wrong. That further destabilizes you, especially if you grew up in an environment where you really believed in journalism.
Right.
And believed in the integrity of the profession. It may sound naive and almost silly these days, but a lot of us did. And if you're faced with that, and you're not just faced with the rejection of because of the story you did, your entire worldview has been shattered, because your worldview is that you're part of this honorable institution, journalism, and when that goes down, along with your own personal situation within it, that is a devastating blow to anybody, and it was a particularly devastating blow to Gary Webb, because, you know, when he first called me, he called me before his story was done, the 96, and I warned him, because I'd been sort of through something similar with this whole process and was somewhat the same story, and I warned him that he was going to face a lot of grief from the big newspapers, because they kind of made their call on this. And the big newspapers don't want to correct anything, especially something as serious as missing a major scandal, a major national security scandal like this. So they were going to, it was just obvious, they were not going to ever back down from their position. And when I talked to Gary and tried to explain that to him, it just didn't compute. He just didn't understand what I was saying. I could have been speaking Chinese to him. So he sort of learned that the hard way. But I think what it showed was that he had just never experienced some of the griminess of working in the Washington news media during that era. And I'd agree with Jeff, during more recent eras too. It hasn't, not like this has been fixed. But it's just, there was this attitude of these smart, clever people who think they know everything. They often get things completely wrong. They follow the lead of powerful, well-connected sources and officials. They're led by the nose. And if you try to challenge any of this at this stage, if you're not with the club, you have to be really punished. And so what Gary was encountering was this clique of, and it was even perhaps in a way worse for him, since he was also representing some outsider news organization. He won in the West Coast, not part of the Washington Club. San Jose Mercury News, obviously, they had their representation in Washington through the Knight Ridder Bureau, but they were essentially outsiders. They weren't part of the inner circle of the news media. So there were a lot of reasons why they went after him the way they did. But I think the fact that he saw this sort of this dark soul, this empty void that had become the center of American journalism during this period, I think that's what really set him off and destabilized him as much as anything.
I agree with that. I think that's very well put.
And Bob Perry, the article that you wrote that appears as the afterword in this new publication, The Killing Game, Gary Webb's collected reporting, you refer to the CIA report. You say, after Volume 1 was released, I called Webb. I chided him for indeed getting the story, quote-unquote, wrong. He had understated how serious the problem of Contra's cocaine trafficking had been. It was a form of gallows humor for the two of us since nothing had changed in the way the major newspapers treated the Contras cocaine issue. They focused only on the press release that continued to attack Webb while ignoring the incriminating information that could be found in the body of the report. How did he respond to your gallows humor?
Well, he understood it by then. This was the first volume of Hitz's report, which was not the most damning in terms of what the CIA was admitting to. The second volume was extremely damning of themselves. This was the second volume was a complete indictment of the CIA. Volume one had some of that, but it was not as extensive as volume two. It dealt more with the California area of this problem of the Contra cocaine trafficking. But you know, he recognized by then that there was no way out. He recognized that he'd already gone through a lot of the pain of this rejection and this being treated as a pariah for going out of his way to really do a hard story and take the chances. You know, he understood that even if, as a journalist, you feel like the people that should understand most of what you go through when you take on that kind of a hard story, going against the government in a very big way, you hope that your colleagues at least will understand and appreciate what you're putting yourself through. This is hard work to do these stories. This is as hard as it gets in many ways in American journalism, and to have it not only treated rejected on sort of substance, but to have the fact that he put so much on the line treated with such disdain by the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and ultimately his own editors, was devastating to him. But by the time I made that phone call, he understood. He'd come to the point of knowing how bad this had gotten. So at that point he wasn't the person who first talked to me. He wasn't a person who was beginning to dawn on him, and certainly had dawned on him, what the real nature of the journalism game was, as we played it in that period of the 80s, 90s, and then over the past decade.
We're talking about this new collection of news reports written by Gary Webb. It's called The Killing Game, and it's a fascinating read. There's some stories here that really resonate with me. One about the collapsed freeway in Oakland, the Cypress Freeway that fell down during the World Series earthquake in October of 1989. I covered that as well, including the story of a man named Nick Zaninovich, who was over 6 feet tall, but escaped with his life, even though he was crushed under that collapsing freeway in a little Chevy Vega or some other subcompact like that. It was quite a touching story. Also, he writes about bad cops, and he's the first I know to have used the characterization DWB, driving while black. And perhaps the most powerful story in it is called The Mighty Wurlitzer Plays On, which is Gary Webb's own account of the aftermath of the Dark Alliance series and how he responded to that. And I want to read a quote from close to the end of that piece. This is Gary Webb. Do we have a free press today? Sure we do. It's free to report all the sex scandals at once, all the stock market news we can handle, every new health fad that comes down the pike, and every celebrity marriage or divorce that happens. But when it comes to the real down and dirty stuff, stories like Tailwind, the October Surprise, the El Mazote Massacre, corporate corruption, or CIA involvement in drug trafficking, that's where we begin to see the limits of our free press. In today's media environment, sadly, such stories are not even open for discussion. And Jeffrey Klein, it's only gotten worse since he penned those words.
Oh, there's no question. I think it's gotten significantly worse. Off the top of my head, I'd say a major reason is the job security of the top professionals and their power in the world is diminished. So when the club that you're in is a more tenuous club, you're going to play by the rules a lot more. So he there's, as Bob has been alluding to, there's basically received wisdom. There's areas where you can go beyond the received wisdom and make a reputation for yourself. But in national security reporting in particular, you are so dependent on informed sources tell us, or sources who should know this or that tell us. If you look at basically the security news that comes out any day in the Post or the Times, it's basically coming from insiders who are doing you a favor. And if you threaten that favor network, you're going to be a cast off. You're not going to be able to get the stories, and you're going to lose your access to the front page, and you're going to lose your access to the talk shows. If you go back and you look at how wrong, how disastrously wrong the biggest names in this business have been, it's quite frightening. I'm going to give an example that Bob may disagree with. I would say best contrast to Gary Webb's career is Bob Woodward's career. Bob Woodward, in my opinion, leaving aside his initial great reporting, has essentially done books that don't really threaten the power establishment. They don't tell you things that they tell you little tidbits and gossipy items, but they don't basically tell you things that the government doesn't want you to know. Gary Webb defined journalism as the highest part here is I'm going to give you a truth that really people in power don't want you to know. And yet Bob Woodward is the most celebrated investigative journalist of our era because he's essentially a stenographer for Colin Powell or whoever else will talk to him. And that's the direction we've gone. People have become embedded stenographers. And the few that, like Gary, are... Gary is a whistleblower, and whistleblowers are often kicked out of their organization. So for me, his story is the most important journalistic story of our lifetime because it defines really the risks you take to do serious journalism. And I think those risks have only gotten greater. I'd be curious if you agree with that, Bob.
No, Jeff, I do agree with that. I would say this about Woodward. I do find useful some of his insights or some of the stenography he does. Because it does fill in certain voids. But you saw it with Woodward, and this is an interesting. Actually, the New York Times did a pretty interesting. I think Jill Abramson wrote it, a review of a number of his books during the Bush era, and when George W. Bush was at his height. Of power and influence, and everyone was sort of just cowering in front of him. And people sort of laugh now, but that's really what it was back in the post 9/11 period, and going on through the big chunk of the Iraq War until 2005 or so, before he began to have some cracks in his image. But the if you look at the early books that Woodward did about the Bush's wars, they were fawning, totally uncritical, very accepting of all this. And then as Bush's popularity declined and it became safer to sort of be critical of Bush, Woodward becomes more critical of Bush. So you see this kind of, instead of someone saying, listen, I'm going to take on the these people at their most powerful, when they're actually doing the most damage.
Mm-hmm.
The role of much of Washington journalism is to sort of bow and scrape before them when they are at their most powerful, when journalism is most desperately needed. Critical
right.
journalism, and then only when they're being kicked around by everybody do they jump in and start kicking a few times too. And I've always found that kind of journalism very distasteful. To sort of go with the flow, to be part of a mob almost, to both be cowering before them when they're powerful, and then pounding on them when they're weak. It should be in a sense almost the opposite. That you should really be taking them on when they're the most powerful, but. That is what's happened to national journalism. And when I was at Newsweek, there was almost a sense it didn't matter that your stories were wrong.
Right.
It was that you had good sources for them.
Right.
You know, so you'd have Colin Powell, you know, whispering in your ear, and I'd be at these meetings and on Iran-Contra, for instance, and I knew a lot of those details, and I knew these guys were lying the administration at that time, the Reagan administration, was lying through its teeth on some of this stuff, I'd be told, oh, no, no, we have very good sourcing on this. And it would be from Colin Powell or James Baker or one of these very self-interested characters who should never be trusted. But at the time, certainly Powell was considered almost, golden. Who would ever question Colin Powell's honesty and integrity? And it was that failure to actually look at people and do what you're supposed to do as a journalist. Be open-minded. Be objective. Be critical. Actually do the reporting. Actually get your information together, and then somehow evaluate what someone's telling you. Instead, it was very much, well, we heard this at the cocktail party, and we're going with it. And I think journalism, we saw this slide, and it's been a slide, a very steady slide since, I would say, the mid-70s, after the Watergate, Pentagon Papers, CIA abuses scandals that Cy Hirsch did for the New York Times back in that era. Really, from then on, it's been the major U.S. news organizations have largely been living on their reputations.
Right.
Certainly, the Washington Post is in that category, and certainly Bob Woodward is in that category. So Jeff, I don't disagree at all with your point. I think it's actually very well made and very astute.
Well, gentlemen, thank you for a great discussion here today. I appreciate your work to honor the legacy of Gary Webb and the standards of journalism that he adhered to. And I would be remiss if I didn't thank you as individuals for the work that you have done in bringing important stories to the attention of the public. Jeffrey Klein, Robert Perry, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We continue here on the Peter B. Collins Show. On March 11th, the earthquake and the tsunami that followed did very severe damage to the Fukushima nuclear reactor family or cluster in northeastern Japan. And we now know the Japanese authorities, including the TEPCO Power Company, the utility that owns those plants, have not been honest with the Japanese public or the world public at large about the severity of the damage and other issues, including the continuing threats to the nearby population, to produce and animals in the area, and, of course, to the sea life in the surrounding area because of all the leakage of seawater that was poured on the reactors in the days and weeks after the events of March 11th. Kevin Camps returns to our program today. He is the Radioactive Waste Watchdog, that's his title, at Beyond Nuclear, and their website is beyondnuclear.org. Kevin, good to talk with you again.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
I guess where I'd like to start is just with what we now know about the severity of the damage at the cluster of reactors in Fukushima. And the news has come out slowly, but at the end of May, it was essentially confirmed that lies were told, the damage was underreported, and there were meltdowns in three of the cores of the reactor cluster there at Fukushima.
Well, just as you said, Tokyo Electric Power Company seems to have hidden a lot of information for as long as possible. But yes, indeed, units 1, 2, and 3 could have experienced complete meltdowns, which means that the radioactive core, the nuclear fuel, has turned into a molten liquid and gathered on the bottom of the reactor pressure vessel itself in each of those units, and very likely burned through those reactor pressure vessels. The final line of defense would be the primary containment structure, and apparently the cooling operations that are ongoing are an attempt to try to prevent that final leakage through that final layer of defense, because the secondary containment buildings, if your listeners have seen the photographs, are damaged or entirely destroyed. I mean, the Unit 3 reactor building is a pile of rubble.
Yeah.
Point.
Yeah.
So the final line of defense against large-scale radioactivity releases from those reactors is that primary containment structure, which is a concrete and steel structure, and so they are desperately still trying to cool those melted-down cores, which are now molten pools, from burning through that final layer. The other bad news involves the pools of high-level radioactive waste storage at the multiple units. Those are not contained within a primary containment structure, so if those pools boil dry, if the wastes inside catch on fire, those are direct radioactivity releases into the environment. That, too, is an ongoing risk. They have taken extraordinary measures, failed drops of water by helicopters, ongoing water cannons and fire trucks firing water into these pools to try to keep them filled, because they have yet to establish ongoing cooling mechanisms in these facilities. It's very much ad hoc at this point.
Now, Kevin, let's start, first of all, with what they knew and when they knew it. I have to believe that the officials on site at Fukushima Daiichi, and there is a separate Fukushima complex a little south of there, the Fukushima Daini, but at Daiichi, they certainly knew the impact of the tsunami, and also that there could have been initial damage from the earthquake itself. And yet they operated with a lot of kind of happy talk and putting the best spin on things. When do you think the officials actually knew about this, and why did it take them 75 days to disclose it to the public?
Well, the devil's in the details. There's a lot of dust left to settle, pardon the pun, but you know, the cover-up is so serious that the Japanese federal government at the highest levels, we're talking the prime minister and his immediate spokespeople, are starting to push back on Tokyo Electric Power Company. Unfortunately, Tokyo Electric Power Company has largely been in charge of the information flow, and the federal government there has largely just conveyed TEPCO's revelations as if they were facts. Well, now we realize that there's been a lot of cover-up thus far. As you said, 75 days of cover-up trying to maintain that those reactor cores in units 1, 2, and 3 were being cooled, that there had been partial meltdowns, but now we're seeing that probably we've experienced full meltdowns in the very first days of this disaster. In fact, like you said, it appears that the unit 1 core began its meltdown even before the tsunami hit.
Mm.
So that was about the one-hour point of this disaster, and there's indications now that that meltdown was well underway before the tsunami hit. But certainly once the tsunami hit, it took out the emergency diesel generators and plunged units 2 and 3, as well as those pools, into the crisis state. And so units 2 and 3 experienced their meltdowns in the first days. And those hydrogen explosions, if your listeners have seen the video, I mean, another unprecedented nature of this catastrophe is the mere fact that on live television, these hydrogen explosions were played in real time. And the hydrogen very likely came from the nuclear fuel rods cladding, interacting with steam, generating hydrogen, which then built up as they desperately tried to vent the over-pressurizing reactor containment structures. They vented that hydrogen into the secondary reactor containment building, which then detonated. And in the case of Unit 2, Unit 2, ironically, looks like the reactor building is largely intact, even though there's holes. There are some holes in the walls. Unit 2 is probably the most damaged primary containment structure. There are two primary containment structures that TEPCO and even the Japanese government and even the International Atomic Energy Agency admit are damaged. Unit 2, they say, is severely damaged. And mm-hmm. as I mentioned, that's the last line of defense. It could well explain why the radioactivity releases to the atmosphere and to the ocean have been so high, at such a high radioactivity level, because we've got leakage from Unit 2's reactor pressure vessel and primary containment structure into the external environment.
And what about the further complication at Unit 3, Kevin, where they had an enriched fuel with extra plutonium? I guess it's kind of like high-test uranium.
Yes, 6% of the Unit 3 core had been loaded with what's called MOX fuel, which is short for uranium-plutonium mixed oxide fuel. and they were on the way to loading a full 33% of that core with plutonium. Fortunately, I guess you could say only 6% was plutonium. And I was actually invited to Fukushima Daiichi itself last August as a part of the campaign by the local anti-nuclear movement and the national anti-nuclear movement of Japan to stop the loading of plutonium fuel into Japanese reactors across the country. Unfortunately, it failed just a couple weeks after I visited in August. They actually loaded that 6% plutonium core. It's fair to say that doing that contributed to the overheating of the core at Unit 3 because plutonium burns hotter than uranium, and it also is contributing to radiological releases and the toxicity and the hazard. As you said, plutonium is ultra-hazardous as well. Just a microscopic speck inhaled into the human lung will initiate lung cancer over time. It's almost guaranteed.
Kevin Camp's with us, and I'm looking at the beyondnuclear.org website right now. And, Kevin, this was the first time that I saw the news from May 29th of Unit 5 at Fukushima Daiichi. And this, we were told, was a unit that had automatically shut down during the earthquake trauma, or was it shut down beforehand? I'm not clear on that.
Actually, Units 4, 5, and 6 were not operating. They were down for inspections and or maintenance at the time, fortunately.
Okay.
But Units 1, 2, and 3 were operating at full power, and they immediately scrammed within seconds of the earthquake, but it's not good enough. You have to continue to cool the radioactive cores of operating reactors for many days before you reach cold shutdown. So technically speaking, as you indicated, Units 4, 5, and 6 were already in cold shutdown before the disaster struck. But incredibly, they just experienced, perhaps this may go back to March 11th itself, but just yesterday was it revealed that there's an oil slick off of Unit 5. Apparently, these large, heavy oil containers holding 1 million liters each, and there's two of them, so 2 million liters of heavy crude oil, were moved 30 feet by the earthquake and perhaps even the tsunami. They were being filled as the natural disaster struck, and now there's an admission by TEPCO that there's a 300-meter-long oil slick into the ocean that they're trying to contain with booms, but it's incredible. Even at the shutdown reactors, they are experiencing oil spills, fires, and also the threat of the pools for high-level radioactive waste storage at those shutdown reactors overheating. And in fact, Unit 4, this is now up for debate as to what exactly happened, but Unit 4 experienced a large-scale hydrogen explosion. And the mystery is what caused it. At first, it was thought that it was the boiling away of the water in the storage pool for high-level radioactive waste, and then the waste catching on fire, releasing its hazards directly into the atmosphere, including hydrogen gas, which then exploded. Apparently, that theory is now under debate. And another theory that's taking precedence is that Unit 3 and 4 share a venting system, and perhaps hydrogen gas generated by Unit 3, which also suffered a massive explosion, went over into the Unit 4 secondary containment building and blew the place apart for the most part. So, you know, the devil's in the details, a lot of dust to settle. We're yet to even understand the basics of what caused certain of the large-scale explosions.
Now, Kevin, circling back for a minute here to this oil slick resulting from a leak at Unit 5, that would be radioactive oil on the that's mostly floating on the surface of the sea just offshore from Fukushima. What are the risks of trying to clean up oil? That's difficult enough, but if it's radioactively charged, then that's an even greater risk to the humans who would be involved in such an operation.
Well, you're right. There's still a lot to be figured out about how bad the radioactivity is building up. Greenpeace has reported discovering radioactive edible seaweed even 30 kilometers or about 20 miles off the Fukushima coast. So the food chain and the ecosystem, the ecology, is reconcentrating the radioactivity that's being released in large amounts from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. The Japanese federal government, from the first days of this catastrophe, was trying to downplay the oceanic releases, saying that it's a big ocean, it will dilute, don't worry about it, it'll go away, as if it was disappearing into nothingness. Well, there's a phenomenon called bioaccumulation, which reconcentrates the radioactivity up the food chain. And now, as you said, with this oil, if there are people sent in to deal with the oil spill, which I imagine must be a low priority given what else is going on the site, they're going to be exposed to the radioactivity that is in the ocean, and levels that even Tokyo Electric and the Japanese government have admitted to have included millions of time permissible doses of things like radioactive iodine-131 in the seawater, which then seaweed and kelp will concentrate yet more. And that probably explains why Greenpeace found such high levels even 20 miles offshore.
And, Kevin, what is the overall risk of radioactivity in the seawater? Because we know that tens of thousands, I have no idea how many gallons of seawater were pumped out and onto the overheated reactors during the attempts to cool them. Do we have any way of calculating what that level of risk is, and how far from Fukushima that radioactive elements in the water might spread?
Well, a figure I just saw in the last couple days is that 100,000 tons of water have been poured onto these four units in crisis, 100,000 tons of cooling water. And another figure from many weeks ago is that 11,500 tons of that cooling water were then discharged intentionally into the ocean to free up storage space for even more highly contaminated radioactive water. They are very ad hoc at this point. They're using buildings on the site to store these large volumes of water that are radioactively contaminated that were never intended for that purpose. They're using radioactive waste storage buildings. They're using a radioactive waste incineration building, which is kind of scary on its face. And they're using other facilities just to pump water into, because as they pour water continuously onto these melting down reactors to try to cool them, that water is leaking out and they have to put it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, some of it they've intentionally released into the ocean. Some of it has accidentally leaked into the ocean through cracks probably caused by the earthquake, and then they've tried to patch those cracks. They've even proposed bringing in floating barges, which would be hollow in the center, and then pouring, you know, vast amounts of radioactive water into these barges, which, you know, theoretically would be contained, but it would be floating on the ocean. And a big question remains, where will the water go to? And now they're bringing in from Areva of France, a large French government-owned nuclear company. They're bringing in from Russia these radioactive water processing units. And it'll be a race, though, to try to keep up with the huge amounts that they're generating.
Now, let's.
You had asked, what is the risk further out in the ocean?
Yeah, how far does this radiate?
Well, the currents from Japan, the large-scale currents, actually flow to the U.S. West Coast, to the North American West Coast. So the currents will carry the radioactivity dissolved in the seawater this away. The Japanese federal government and Tokyo Electric would like people to think that it just disappears into nothingness. Well, it does dilute, but I mentioned that reconcentration mechanism called bioaccumulation up the food chain. And then there are species of fish like albacore tuna and certain species of salmon, which actually physically migrate from Japan to the west coast of North America. So they, too, being high up on the food chain themselves, are going to be bringing radioactive contamination in their very flesh to North America.
So let's turn now to the airborne release of radiation. And you referred to some of the explosions we certainly saw in the early days of the crisis on television, several of the explosions, and you could see the destruction of the external containment structures on the reactors. And so give us a sense of what we know and what is still unknown about the extent of airborne releases and the level of radioactivity emanating from them.
Well, from the very earliest hours even of this catastrophe, and certainly the first days, they were intentionally venting the primary containment structures of radioactive steam into the environment to try to prevent a catastrophic breach of those primary containment structures due to overpressurization. It was an indication of how small and how weak these primary containment structures are. That weakness has been known for many decades, back to like 1972 here in the U.S. And we have 23 identical reactor designs here in the U.S. They're called General Electric Boiling Water Reactors of the Mark I design. We've known, you know, since 1972 that these containments would not live up to an accident and the pressures and the temperatures. So they intentionally released radioactivity. That didn't even work. It actually contributed to the explosions that took place with the hydrogen gas. And since then, there have been fires in Unit 4. Again, the pools, the storage pools for high-level radioactive waste, are located high up in these buildings above or next to the reactors. They are now facing the open sky. There was no containment whatsoever over the pools. There was never a primary containment that's reinforced concrete and steel. Just this industrial building, well, that's gone. And so if there are releases from the pools, then that's directly into the atmosphere. Those hydrogen explosions led to acute spikes of radioactivity when they took place. So that has flowed with the air currents all over the northern hemisphere. There have been elevated readings of radioactivity documented in North America, Canada, and the U.S., as well as in Europe. There have been warnings from, for example, a group called CRIRAD in France, which is an environmental group, but they're a radiological testing laboratory. That's their specialty. They came into being to counter the French government's dismissal back in 1986 that Chernobyl fallout was reaching France. So they busted the French government back then, lying. Well, they're still active, and they have shown fallout in France from Fukushima. And they have warned people in France against what they call risky behavior, which they mean consuming dairy products, actually. They're warning people about the consumption of dairy products because it will contain radioactive iodine and other fallout from Fukushima.
And, Kevin, we've seen that despite cultural barriers, Japanese citizens have been much more assertive and aggressive in confronting TEPCO, the utility, and the national government regarding evacuations, regarding whether it's safe for young people, for example, to be within a certain radius of the plant. And I'm wondering what your sense is of the level of confidence we should have in the United States government, in our ability to monitor radioactivity airborne or in the sea or in the food chain, and can we rely on our government to tell us the truth in the event we reach levels that we should be concerned about?
Well, I'm not an expert on Japanese culture. I've been lucky enough to visit there a couple times for this anti-nuclear work in the past 10 years. And just from my own observations, the Japanese people are very meek people, very courteous, polite in most circumstances, almost across the board. So this very passionate activism that's underway in Japan by the parents of Fukushima to protect their young children against radioactivity in their schoolyards is really remarkable, that people are willing to confront very directly Tokyo Electric and various levels of government right up to the top levels of the Japanese education ministry. And they've just reversed the Japanese government's attempt to allow, to permit children to be exposed to 20 times the level of radioactivity at school than was previously allowed before Fukushima started. They've gotten that reversed, luckily. It's going to require government in Japan to remove the topsoil at schools if they want to keep these schools open, to get rid of the radioactive contamination that's already fallen out there. They were, you know, at 2 rem per year for school children. That would have been equivalent to what nuclear power plant workers in Germany are allowed to get in a year. So that's been reversed. It's really good news. It's taken a month and a half to accomplish that. Lots of protests in Tokyo by Fukushima parents. So here in the United States, what we're looking at, about a month ago, the Obama administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Food and Drug Administration, put out an announcement that they are largely to entirely dismantling any emergency radiation monitoring that they had put in place, and it wasn't much, post-Fukushima. Now we're back to the normal, once every 3 months we'll look at the milk supply to see how bad the radioactivity is. Once a month we'll look at the rainwater. It's incredible. It's like the Obama administration, the federal government here, does not want to know what's in the air, what's in the water, what's in the food. So we need to take leadership from the Japanese people and get very active here in the United States, just in our own self-interest. We need to protect our food supply. This catastrophe is still underway. It is not under control. They still have three melted down cores that they're desperately trying to cool. They have multiple pools of high-level radioactive waste that they're desperately trying to keep full of water. So how we can dismantle our radiation monitoring systems, given the global scope of this catastrophe, is just beyond me, and we need to change that.
And Kevin, what is the status of Fukushima Daiichi? That is a three-plant cluster that is south of Fukushima Daiichi. Am I correct?
Yeah, it's just 7 miles to the south. And when I was there last August, I stood midway between them on a bluff that looked out over the Pacific Ocean. And you look to the north, 3.5 miles, and it's Fukushima Daiichi with its 6 units. You look 3.5 miles to the south, and it's Daiichi with 4 units, actually.
Both
owned and operated by Tokyo Electric Power Company. I just learned this about a week ago at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguard Subcommittee meeting on Fukushima. A Department of Energy official, just in passing, mentioned that by the skin of its teeth, Fukushima Daiichi, the other plant with 4 reactors, was able to continue cooling its cores and its pools because a single power line from the external grid survived the earthquake and tsunami. He said the tsunami was actually bigger at Daiichi than it was at Daiichi, but fortunately, and I don't think this was entirely intentional by Tokyo Electric, Daiichi was built at a higher elevation. So bigger tsunami, but the plant was at a higher elevation. Its diesels were taken out, just like at Daiichi. The emergency diesel generators were destroyed by the tsunami. Fortunately for the world, those 4 reactors continued their cooling because of a single off-site power line.
Kevin, one of the people I'm in touch with is anti-nuke activist Harvey Wasserman. He's the author of a book called Solartopia. And he sent out an email blast over a week ago, calling on the world community to gather and really shame the Japanese into basically doing what was done at Chernobyl, to pour concrete into these reactors and form a sarcophagus to seal them up. Do you know if that is in the offing, and if TEPCO and the Japanese government need a nudge to move to that step?
Well, I think Harvey's essay there was really brilliant because it called on the global community to join together and deal with this catastrophe for what it is, which is a global catastrophe. This is not a catastrophe for Tokyo Electric, and they have shown themselves to be not entirely forthcoming with the truth. And it really is going to take the resources of more than even the Japanese government, which is one of the biggest economies on the planet. This is too big for them to deal with. So, yes, there has been some cooperation. I mean, the U.S. military, which is stationed in Japan, you know, all these decades after World War II, were still there.
Yeah.
They were involved and still are from the very first minutes of this catastrophe at Fukushima Daiichi. But it's going to take a whole lot more than that. And, yes, you know, incredibly, 25 years and more after the Chernobyl catastrophe, they have yet to replace that original sarcophagus, which is at risk of collapse and causing a second Chernobyl catastrophe, the radioactive dust cloud that would come out from that collapse. Well, they are about $800, $900 million short and of paying for a new sarcophagus to be built over it. And, yes, we're going to have to do something like that at Fukushima Daiichi, but the thing is, the fire's not out yet, so to speak. The molten cores have to be continuously cooled for a very long time. We're talking a year or two. Again, last week, the Department of Energy official at this NRC meeting said that the Unit 1 core is going to have to be cooled, actively cooled, for a year before it reaches cold shutdown. Units 2 and 3 will have to be cooled for the better part of 2 years. So the complication is you can't just build a big concrete enclosure with these molten cores still needing cooling. You're going to have to provide that cooling actively for that long a time.
Wow.
And Chernobyl was on fire for 10 days.
Mm-hmm. And that just leads to other complications, including continuing high levels of radioactivity at the site, the potential for airborne and waterborne emissions, and the risk to the surrounding population. So, Kevin, let's talk about something that's a little bit more positive and brighter, and that is that the nation of Germany has made a very powerful decision to basically phase out nuclear power over the next 10 years. Tell us about that.
It's an incredible and wonderful piece of news. And yes, I mean, at what cost? It's really born out of the Fukushima nuclear catastrophe. But not only that, the German anti-nuclear movement has been very active, that's an understatement, for many decades, actually. And it's a testament to their amazing work over the decades. So what happened in Germany was that back in the year 2000, the Social Democrats, which is like our Democratic Party, and the Green Party, which is very vibrant in Germany, achieved what was called the nuclear phase-out consensus. This was in 2000, 11 years ago, that by 2020, give or take, they were going to phase out nuclear power in Germany. Well, Angela Merkel and her conservative coalition a couple years ago won the prime ministership, and they have worked ever since for the past year to undo that phase-out plan. And they were well on their way to extending the operations of German reactors for another 12 or 14 years. They weren't going to phase out nuclear power until 2036. Well, Fukushima happened, and then in late March, there was a state election near Stuttgart. It's called Baden-Württemberg State in Germany. And the conservatives had controlled that state legislature for 60 years. They lost the election to the Greens.
Wow.
There have been other regional elections where the Greens have won the regional elections. And so Angela Merkel sees the writing on the walls. The German people want to phase out nuclear power. And if she did not do this backflip, this 360-degree turn, her political career would be over instantly. And it still may well be over. We'll see with the upcoming federal elections in Germany. But she is now fully committed to a nuclear phase-out by 2022. They instantly, when Fukushima began, closed down their 7 oldest reactors in Germany. Those will never restart. That is a permanent shutdown now. The other 10 remaining reactors in Germany, they, like you said, will phase them out in the next 10 years. So that's about 1 nuclear reactor shutting down each year in Germany for the next decade. And their plan, Germany is already a world leader in energy efficiency, solar, photovoltaic power, and wind power. Their plan is to dramatically expand efficiency and renewables even more in the next 10 years.
And Kevin, of course, on the heels of the example set by Germany, the United States has done what?
President Barack Obama has stood by his guns and called for a $36 billion expansion in the Nuclear Loan Guarantee Program to build new reactors in this country at taxpayer financial risk. And the money grab is happening yet again on Capitol Hill. The nuclear power industry is looking for not just that $36 billion expansion. They would love a $100 billion expansion. We've been fighting against this for the past 10 years, first under Bush and Cheney and now under Obama. It just shows how powerful a player the nuclear power industry is in this country. They spend, from 1999 to 2009, we know that they spent $645 million on federal lobbying and an additional $64 million on federal campaign contributions. So the nuclear power industry sees the White House and Congress as the best democracy money can buy, and we're really up against it. Folks need to contact their 2 U.S. senators and their U.S. representative and President Obama and tell them, no way, no more bailouts for an industry that's enjoyed public subsidies in the hundreds of billions of dollars for over 50 years now in the country.
And Kevin, did I hear correctly that there was a plan to build 2 new reactors in Texas, and that has been canceled?
It was the next candidate for a nuclear loan guarantee. They were poised to get one from the Obama administration, but it turned out that their major partners are Tokyo Electric Power Company, Toshiba Nuclear of Japan, Hitachi Nuclear of Japan, and even the Japanese government, the Japan Bank for International Cooperation, were major partners in that proposal at South Texas Project. The U.S. partner, called NRG, Energy of Princeton, New Jersey, as soon as Fukushima was just a few weeks underway, they said that they were not going to spend another penny on the proposal. They would still like to get a license from the Nuclear Rubber Stamp Commission, as I call it, which gives away licenses. They go through the motions, but they will grant that license in the end. And then NRG, I suppose, hopes to sell it to somebody else who's crazy enough to actually try to build the thing.
Okay, so it's not dead yet. It's just on hold. Is that the better way to characterize
it? Well, it probably is dead, but, you know, they will do their utmost to see this thing through. There are other projects that are in a similar situation, like France wanted to build a reactor in Maryland. The U.S. partner pulled out, and Electricité de France, which is government-owned, also Areva of France, which is government-owned, they're hoping to keep that thing alive. They still want to build their reactor in Maryland, but whether or not there's a U.S. company crazy enough to do what the local utility thought was too crazy to actually do, we'll have to see.
Well, Kevin, I really appreciate this update and the great detail that you can offer our listeners. Is there anything we didn't touch on that you'd like to cover before we wrap up?
Oh, wow. Well, I would just encourage people to reach out to your local anti-nuclear groups. They're all over the country. Every atomic reactor in this country has a watchdog group. And if you need help finding them, you know, just contact us. Our website is beyondnuclear.org. We try to put Fukushima updates on the homepage every day.
All right. Kevin, I really appreciate your work. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
You bet. That's Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at beyondnuclear.org. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. I welcome your comments by email. Address it to fullofit@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.